Bing stealing Google's results, what is internet, and the white iPhone. All that and more on the Slongcast. Hey everybody, welcome to this week's edition of the Slongcast, episode 22 for Tuesday, February 8th, 2011. As usual, I am your host, Kevin Slonka, and with me this week, Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Hey, how's it going?
It's been a long day, Ryan. I'm not going to lie, it's been a long day.
Yeah, I heard something about fried brains.
Oh, my brain is fried.
Yeah, it sounds like that sequel to Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, more like the sequel to Fried Green Tomatoes. Fried Kevin's Brains.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, my class today, we just had a lot of typos we had to fix and a lot of troubleshooting. It was rough. Not going to lie, it was rough.
Rough.
All right, so let's jump right into it. This week's top story is something that kind of puts egg on the faces of two companies. Google is accusing Bing of stealing their search results.
Nuh-uh.
Hey. So here's what happened with this. Some Google engineers noticed recently that whatever the first couple search results, the top hits were for whatever they decided to search for, the exact same top hits would show up on Bing. So this kind of struck them, and what they ended up doing was they reformatted a bunch of laptops, gave it a plain load, gave it to their engineers to take home over their Christmas break, and they told them, you know, every day over the break, we want you to search for these specific strings. They're not real words. They're just jibber-jabber, made-up stuff. And, you know, once a day, search for these things on Google so that they get cached by our algorithms and they do whatever they do. And if our theory is correct, within a couple weeks, we should start seeing those exact same results for flibber-flabber show up on Bing. And that's exactly what happened. After about 2 or 3 weeks, Bing's results for the exact same nonsense, not even real things, started being the exact same as Google. So it was very clear to them that Bing was stealing from Google's search results somehow. So Ryan, you submitted the next two articles, which is basically Bing's response to Google accusing them.
Yeah, Microsoft pretty much said, nuh-uh, nuh-uh.
Nuh-uh. And Google's like, yeah.
Yeah, and they're like, nuh-uh. Well, I really think that this is like both companies kind of being childish about it. Well, I don't know. I mean, I think Microsoft's response, at least the one of them, was fairly professional. There was a couple of different blog responses.
And they also called them out on stage at a conference where a person from Google and a person from Microsoft were on stage at the same time, and they like argued about it.
Oh,
live on stage at a conference.
Oh, I didn't see that.
That was crazy.
Pretty interesting. Well, I mean, so the explanation from basically everyone else, in the Bing blog, there's a blog for from the Bing team, and they talk about what happened. It's from Yusuf Mehdi, the senior vice president of online services division from Microsoft. He talked about like what happened, and essentially, the way that they did this, that Google did this, is that they actually installed the Bing search bar on these computers. Okay, they created a honeypot, these 30 or 40 search terms they're gibberish, like Kevin was saying, and they come
That's
up,
me.
Yeah, and they come up with real results, or even like made up results. I think a couple of them were made up, and then they had their employees hit these search terms on Google, but they had the Bing toolbar installed, okay? And they also must have enabled the ability of Bing to, there's a EULA agreement that says, hey, we're going to like look at what you do and provide this back to Bing to give you better search results in Bing.
Oh, so even if you're not searching on Bing, the Bing toolbar picks out things you're searching for.
Right. I mean, it's a web extension, and if you allow it to do those things, it's going to monitor your there's a lot of software that just monitors what
right.
you do.
Some people might offer they don't have a choice.
Right.
You know,
what's that?
Some people might say they don't have a choice. They just wanted the Bing search bar, and if they want that available to them, then they have to let them monitor their results, because if you don't like that, you don't get the search bar.
Well, actually, I think the Bing, it asks you. I mean, I think...
Oh, it does ask you that.
Yeah, I think it asks you. You know, and it's... I think the feature is called, like, enhanced search or something like that. You know, even Google does this. They... When you, at least when you used to install the Google's toolbar, these it's since like kind of gone by the wayside, but it was pretty popular before Chrome existed. The Google's toolbar for IE and Firefox asked you, "Hey, do you want us to enhance your search results?" You know, and I don't know exactly what they did, but they also had this question when you would sign up,
right?
As does much of their other desktop software that they have. So anyway, so this search bar monitored their search terms, and eventually, for some reason, the algorithm felt it necessary to index the results that that were coming up in Google. So now, there's one other piece of the puzzle. It watches what you do, but it only logs it if you click on the link. So you would have to search for the term, like this nonsensical term, like, you know, flibber flabber, and like the honeypot inside of Google brings up Hewlett Packard's website, okay? Then you would have to click on Hewlett Packard's website. Then the Bing toolbar would say, okay, I didn't really understand that search term, but apparently there's some human relation between that search term.
So now I'm going to learn from it.
And I'm going to learn, okay? So then it would send those results back to Bing. And if it got enough of those results, or I don't know what the algorithm is. It could be one, it could be many. Indications are that it's not just one, and I'll tell you why in a minute. But so it would, you know, log that and index it. So then if you search on that term in Bing, like flibber flabber, then it would come up with the Hewlett Packard website. And then Bing said, oh, this is copying. Now, the reason it appears to be copying on the surface is that these terms are nonsensical. There's no other results in the index. Like, both search engines produce one result for that term because it's a nonsensical, non-English language term, non any language term,
right, bunch of letters.
Yeah. So here's why I and others suppose that it takes more than one hit, you know, of the search term and a click on the link, because they made like 30 or 40 terms, but only a couple of them ended up being indexed by Bing. Not all of them. At least their report doesn't say all of them were.
Right.
So I don't really think this is such a bad thing. I don't think this. Microsoft stated that their search algorithm takes into account thousands of different inputs, things from their search engine, things about the user. They probably, if the user's logged in via like Microsoft sign in ID or live ID, then it's going to obviously probably look at their profile to help hone results. Also, if you have the Bing toolbar installed, whatever it does extra that with that search, enhanced search.
Right. Yeah, here's a... Like, I can see, in terms of a Google engineer's point of view, you know, these guys, you know, that's their job, the search algorithm. They work day and night to make sure that this is perfect, that it's the best search algorithm out there, and they do things that other search engines don't. And then all of a sudden, just because, you know, some toolbar is sniffing your traffic, they're able to figure out what Google's algorithm is doing. You know, in a way, I can see the Google engineers thinking that they stole it. You know, we put in all this time and effort, and all you have to do is watch our people use it, and now you know what we do. So I can see an engineer getting upset, you know,
well,
over that.
Well, I think that initially on the surface, if you don't really look into it, I actually kind of, in some ways, I'm surprised at Google, because they tend to employ a high caliber of, you know, engineer. And even myself, like at first, you know, when I saw the article, I was like, oh, wow, I'm like copying results. But I really think the press did their best to mislead the readers in copying results.
Right.
You know,
it wasn't necessarily copying like we think of copying.
No, because there's a huge, huge thing that's different from the Google search algorithm to the way Bing's working, in that the user had to click on the link. Like, that's a huge deal. Like, in my opinion, this is why Bing may be better than Google search algorithm. And Bing has continued to gain market share throughout since its inception. It may be better because it actually reads human input. Now, I'm not saying that Google doesn't do this as well, but I don't care who presented you with those links. If it were Google, Yahoo, AltaVista, or just like, oh, I'm on a web page. Maybe I typed in www.whatever.com and I clicked on a link on that page. The Bing toolbar may index that result if it sees enough similarity between that and other people.
Right. Yeah, see, I'm kind of on the fence about that because I know as far as whenever I do searches, say I'm troubleshooting something, I'll search for a term and I'll just click all 10 links on the Google results page. 9 out of 10 might have nothing to do with what I want, but I want to see whether it does or not. So I'll just click all of them. And I think there are a lot of people who do that too. And if Bing puts so much precedence on you clicking a link, they just got 9 out of 10 wrong ideas from me.
They may have, but again, it didn't. Bing somehow didn't index all 40 of these terms. Like, so there's more going on behind the scenes, you know. And again, this is one of 1,000 different inputs, and we have no idea what the weighting is. Like, the weighting could be like, you know, 1% or less. I mean, of 1,000, if you weighted them equally, it'd be like 0.1%.
Yeah, and that's the other thing about this whole article. You know, nobody other than the Google and Bing engineers know deep down what is happening.
Right.
You know, none of the press, not us, nobody knows.
Right. But and just one final point on this, if it truly is like only 0.1% weighting, the reason that it showed up as the top hit is because when a new term enters an index, there are no other results for it. Like, unless they use some other heuristic about the term, like, oh, it might be this. But, you know, that's one instance that for both Google and Bing, there were apparently no heuristics done on that search term to say, oh, it might have been this.
Right.
Like, at least for that example.
Yeah, because so, that might have been thing would have been like Google's, you know, did you mean or something like
well,
that.
Well, right, did you mean, or maybe, I didn't see, maybe it did have a did you mean, but well, like.
Either way, though, that obviously didn't happen because it only brought back one result.
Right.
You know, if
both,
any.
Exactly. Yeah. So I really think this is a lot of sensationalism by the press.
Flibber-flabber.
Yeah, and flibber-flabber. Yeah, exactly.
All right, so last week we talked about a story where there was this extension that allows you to set images to expire. Well, this week we have a story, and this is actually the University of Cambridge's, one of their pages, called the Light Blue Touch Paper. It's one of Andrew Lewis. He's their security researcher who did this. And not expiring, but he is giving a way to make online images kind of not uneditable, but you know that they've been edited. So very similar to the way money are. U.S. currency has watermarks, and if you photocopy it, those show up. You know, the human eye can't see it normally, but if you do something to it, they show up. Well, this guy has found a way to, high-frequency patterns, to put high-frequency patterns in JPEG images. So the human eye can't see them, but once you edit them, and the image processing program that you're using, you know, recompresses, resaves it as a JPEG, that recompression will make those high-frequency patterns visible. So the example they give on the page is the original image is just a gray box. But after he resaved the image and recompressed it, the words void appear.
Yeah.
So what do you think about this? A way, you know, this could stop all of the, you know, the photoshopping that we see, people putting faces on not their bodies and getting people in trouble for it.
Well, there's a couple things that about this technique that I have concern with. I like the effort. I mean, I think it's a good effort, but they mentioned that they have to target, I believe, specific compression settings to get the desired result.
Right. It doesn't work on everyone.
Right. I mean, maybe this is a step in the right direction. I don't think this is like ready for prime time yet. They do give a real world example of where there's an image and then they run it through Google's WAP proxy, it's wireless access protocol. I think it's an old like cell phone standard for accessing the web. So when you pass it through that WAP proxy, they recompress the image for smaller bandwidth, and in doing that, they mess with the image in such a way that this like hack works and it makes the image appear void.
Right.
But I guess the problem is that not everyone's going to recompress using the same settings. There also may be a way to filter this out. Like if you ran the image through some filter, if it's a high frequency signal, and I'm not exactly sure how that would work in an image, but they may be able to remove it. And in addition, they're targeting specific things about the compression algorithm. So I don't think it would be beyond the scope of, realm of possibility that they come up with a new algorithm.
Right.
That would, you know, wouldn't be susceptible to this.
Right. Yeah, I definitely think this is a step in the right direction. I doubt we're going to see it used anytime in the near future. But, you know, that they made it work on money and they made it work on other things. So just a matter of time until they make it work on images. And I hope they do, because I'm getting tired of all of these very awesomely photoshopped images that everyone thinks are real and they turn out not to be.
Well, yeah, it's also a way to protect yourself of, like, you know, I mean, we all want to share pictures and stuff of our lives on online, but we don't want it to become the next, you know, internet meme either.
Right.
You know, for sake of embarrassment or even our jobs. So I think something like this would be very interesting if they could implement it in a foolproof way.
Right.
Very cool.
So our next two articles, the first one, if you look at the show notes, is just kind of for some background, but I'll be talking specifically about the second article. So hopefully all of you know about the group Anonymous. So the group named Anonymous is kind of really an anonymous group of people on the internet who do things most of us would consider illegal, such as hacking companies, trying to take them down. You've probably also seen Anonymous in the news. They're the people who always wear the masks from V from Vendetta. So those people, you know, same group, the Anonymous group. And they're really active in this whole WikiLeaks controversy that has been in the news over the past couple months. And they are so active that they've actually DDoSed, did a distributed denial of service against HB Gary Federal, which is a company that was helping the FBI track down all of the senior members of Anonymous. The government wants to take these guys down because they're attempting to help WikiLeaks by taking down all the companies who are trying to hurt WikiLeaks. So the FBI and probably every other three-letter organization is trying to take them down. But so this HB Gary Federal, the company, they were going to provide information to the FBI. They said publicly that we have all of this information on senior members of Anonymous. We know who they are. We know where they are. We have all this information. So the Anonymous group took them down, and they're like, you know what? You guys suck. All of your information is fake, and to prove it, we're going to post it all on Pirate Bay. So they're like, yeah, we don't care. All your information is wrong. We're going to post it. So they posted it, and I guess there are warrants out for the arrest. As the background article, the one titled Cyber Arrest from Yahoo, says, you know, there are warrants out for people that they think are in the Anonymous group, but really they're not any closer. What do you think of this whole Anonymous situation and maybe just the WikiLeaks situation in general?
Well, you know, rule number one of Hack Club, don't talk about Hack Club.
Okay, next article.
Rule number two of Hack Club, don't help the FBI. No, I don't know. I mean, I really don't know much about Anonymous. I have heard of them, and I've heard of some of these other organizations that, you know, do this like hacking online, you know, online. It's somewhat like online terrorism in a way,
Okay, we don't think that Anonymous are online terrorists because we do not want our servers to be crashed. You are all good people.
Yes, but please don't hurt me.
But no, I agree. That's pretty much what they do. You know, of course, they feel that they're doing it for good causes, such as, you know, they think WikiLeaks is a good thing.
Right. Well, you know, I watched that interview with Julian Assange on 60 Minutes the other week, and I have to say, I was fairly taken aback by how, like, professional and sophisticated this guy is in terms of like what his purposes are. I think you know, he might have been smeared by, I mean, I'm not saying what all of them are doing is 100% legal across the board. It's definitely not
it's
legal.
It's like 99% not legal.
But especially this Anonymous group, I think the difference between them and officially they're not part of the WikiLeaks movement anymore, right? Like they've kind of cut ties. Well, WikiLeaks have cut ties with them.
Yeah, I don't think they ever really were.
They were just kind of helping them behind the scenes.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, the point is, like, this stuff, I mean, a DDoS attack it's illegal, right?
Definitely, yeah.
Yeah, these are things that are, like, they're illegal to do.
Yeah, there's no situation where a DDoS is legal.
Right, whether or not WikiLeaks is legal is questionable because, you know, they could be considered a news organization. And while news organizations have typically followed this, what do you call it?
sort of code of ethics.
Yeah, like a gentleman's agreement.
Right.
It's not really law. It's like, oh, we'll make you aware. But they claim they have made people aware that they were going to release this. And
well, I mean, even so, I don't think there's anything illegal about WikiLeaks. I mean, sure, they might have classified U.S. information, but WikiLeaks is not stored within the U.S. You know, it's foreign to us.
Mm-hmm.
So, sure, the way that they got the information was probably illegal, and that has led to arrests of, military people.
I don't know the law. I don't even know the law, like, regarding, like, what, like, if somebody has stolen information and they give it to the press, if the press is allowed to use it legally, if they're allowed to divulge it.
There's that whole whistleblower act, depending on what the information is.
Right. Well, the Whistleblower Act, though, doesn't protect federal government employees. It only protects private employees. From what I learned on my short research of it and basically watching 60 Minutes.
Well, I think anyone
and that's really all I know of it.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know much either, but I think anyone who works for the government realizes whenever you take that job that, you pretty much can't do anything anymore.
Yeah. That's, I think the lesson is that between this anonymous group and the guy that stole the information and gave it to WikiLeaks, and other things that have happened in the last year, like with we're talking this talk a little later about this, about Egypt with their network and everything else. I mean, Egypt or the internet, I almost said Egypt or net. the internet and modern networks are part of politics and warfare and everything else now. So we have to be mindful of it.
Yeah, and what's interesting, a further thing on this WikiLeaks story, is that Julian Assange is actually, I don't know what it's he's going into court for hearings, but it's about his sexual predator things that he's done.
Yeah.
So he's going to court for that. But because he's going to court for that, I believe it's in Sweden. Now the U.S. has an easier time extraditing him to try him for these WikiLeaks things.
Yeah.
And so that's going to be interesting to see how that all turns out. The U.S. they couldn't do anything to him because it was foreign.
Right.
But now that he's in trouble and he's in the court system, now they can try to extradite him. So moving on along the same line as the group Anonymous, there is also a message board called 4chan. And 4chan, I don't want to compare them with Anonymous because they're not the same, but there are times whenever they do similar things. The group collective, gets together for a specific purpose, and they do things to, generally help people, or what they see as helping people. In this case, it's kind of funny. Or do a DDoS. Yeah, you don't want 4chan or Anonymous working against you. Absolutely. So don't make them mad. But somebody on the 4chan message board saw this eBay post. And in the picture of the post were these two young boys, very young. They look like, 6 and 8 maybe. And one of them is crying, and they're holding up a bag of their little toys. I guess they're called Beyblades. I don't know what they are. I've never heard of them before. But if you read the description of the eBay auction, the mom is selling them because the kids played with them in the bathtub. That was their quote-unquote battle zone. And they played with them so hard that they started chipping away at the ceramic bathtub, and they knocked off the soap holder and put holes in it. And the mom just got fed up, so she took a picture of them crying after she took their toys away, put it on eBay. Somebody from 4chan saw it, and they told everybody else on 4chan. They're like, hey, we have to do something about this. These kids deserve better. So
I'm surprised they didn't get CYS to come down and haul away the mom.
Yeah, that too. So the auction started off at $69. A few hours later, it's up to $500,000. Wow. Everybody on 4chan just started bidding on it like crazy. And you might think, somebody's on the hook to pay that $500,000. And that's normally the case, but in a case where in a few hours the price goes up $400,000, eBay's like, whoa, something is wrong here. So they deleted the auction. The kids got to keep their toys.
Wow, the power of the internet.
Do you have any thoughts on that, on 4chan getting together?
Oh, it just... More hilarity from 4chan.
Yeah, they're always good for something. And even if you've never been on 4chan, you've probably seen...
You don't want to go there.
Well, yeah. Generally, normal people don't want to go there. You need thick skin.
Very, very thick skin and possibly a lawyer.
Very true. But some of their stuff, makes it to sites like Slashdot or Dig, depending on what they're doing. So I'm sure everyone has heard of something they've done.
They're very popular for starting internet memes, I think.
They are the meme generator.
Yeah,
Like the lolcats.
All that, yeah.
All right, so moving on. our next article. Hotmail does something that most email administrators knew about for decades. Hotmail is saying that we can now give you throwaway accounts. And what they're doing is you have a Hotmail account, but maybe whenever you go sign up for this site, you don't want to give them your real email address, the one that you use for everything. So they're saying, we're going to let you make up to 5 fake email accounts that mail will get delivered to your inbox. So it's a way for you to hide your real email address and give out these fake ones to sites that you don't know what they're going to do. Those of us who administer email know these are just email aliases. You know, anybody can make them within 2 seconds if you administer an email system. But what do you think of Hotmail giving users this ability for quote-unquote throwaway accounts?
I like the idea behind it. You know, I was a long-time Yahoo Mail user before Gmail came out, and that was one feature that I still miss in Gmail is the ability that Yahoo had was these. I think they called them. I can't remember the term they gave them. It's something to do with spam or, you know.
It's like temporary account or something. Yeah. I don't know what the name was.
Basically, what you did is you had your normal account, and then you would pick a root name. Like, so my normal name is like Ryan Lancey, and then like your root name, you pick like, you know, Will Wheaton or something like that. I'm looking at the picture behind Kevin right now. He has a picture of Will Wheaton.
And Felicia Day.
Yeah, well, all right, but
totally not gay.
Right, but the only one really naked in the picture is Will Wheaton.
Yeah, he is not wearing a shirt.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. I'm a little grossed out by that. But anyway, so I say I pick Will Wheaton, and then like I add extensions to it, so I can say like dash eBay dash PayPal dash whatever new account I like. So like, right. Say I go to some new website, I can do Will Wheaton dash new website at yahoo.com, and then you can put up filters to filter email from those addresses to separate folders, that which is cool.
Or delete them completely if you don't want them.
Right. And then if you see it filling up with spam, it's just like, oh, delete, you know, yep. Gone. And then you can go change your email address on that website or whatever, or ban them because they gave away your email address.
Right.
So I love the idea of that. I like that idea. I think you can achieve similar results with powerful spam filters. But you know, and I think Gmail does a pretty good job at filtering spam out for the most part.
They are by and far the best spam filter I've ever seen.
Yeah. Now, occasionally something slips into the spam folder that shouldn't be.
That's true. You do have to check every now and then.
That's annoying. But not that that didn't happen on other mail services. But yeah, I think this Hotmail thing, it's nothing new to me. I think it's cool. I wish more, I really wish email providers would give you more control over that.
And here's something that, just from you talking, maybe this is going to be new to you. You can do this in Gmail.
You can?
Okay, so here are two things you can do with Gmail that a lot of people probably don't know. The first thing, Gmail ignores dots in your email address.
Oh, yeah, you can put pluses on there, can't you?
Okay, so let me just talk about the first thing with dots. So my Gmail address is kevinslonka@gmail.com. If you send an email to kevin.slonka@gmail.com or k.e.v.i.n, you could throw any number of dots in the email address. It'll still get delivered to me. Gmail just ignores dots.
Okay.
The cool thing, which goes away with these throwaway email accounts, is you can do kevinslonka+ebay@gmail.com. And it's the exact same thing. You can do as many of them as you want. You can put plus anything. Mail will get delivered to your account, just like it ignores the plus whatever, and now you have the ability to filter based on plus eBay, plus Amazon.
That's cool.
Yeah. So,
but you can't, can you block a plus? Like say, oh, I don't want any more email from plus eBay.
No, you can't really delete them. Yeah. So you can just kind of set up a filter to always send that to trash.
Yeah, yeah. I guess the ability to filter to trash is probably more powerful than even deleting, because then you still see it just in case somebody sends you something.
Yeah, but that's something that a lot of people don't know about Gmail, that you can kind of do these fake spam accounts anyways.
Very cool. TIL.
I don't know what that means.
Today I learned.
Oh, I was thinking the more you know. Dun, 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 dun. So our next article, last week, you know, we were talking about internet kill switches, and Egypt obviously had one, you know, metaphorically,
yeah,
not a real switch.
Something.
And we were talking about whether the United States wanted one. Well, Australia came out and said, no way. We will not do it ever. What do you think of that?
That's pretty cool. I mean, I like governments that stand up for like absolute free speech. There are a couple examples, though, and I don't know if we talked about these last week or not, like where I think maybe the government should have the ability, like if you're being attacked. Yeah, we did mention
a few, right.
But the thing is, like, how do you discriminate between an attack? Like, you know, like, let's say, like, for some crazy reason, people in the United States did rise up, like the people in Egypt, and then the government said, oh, well, that's an attack. We're just going to shut the internet down. So it's kind of like, it's hard to like ride the fence on that stuff. It's kind of one way or the other.
Yeah, depending on who's in control and what their political perspective is, they might think one thing is attack and one thing isn't. Yeah, it's rough. Yeah. But very cool that Australia says, no way, we won't do it.
Yeah.
So I believe the next couple articles are yours.
Oh, yeah. So interesting thing. We talked a couple Slongcasts ago about how rapid the development of Chrome, the Chrome browser, has been. Chrome 9's out. It's gone stable with the new WebGL standard and Chrome Instant. The nice thing about WebGL is I think this is kind of like a more modern version of VRML. Everyone's familiar with VRML.
Nobody's probably really familiar because nobody really ever got a chance to see it. Nobody ever did it, really.
There's been sites that used it. I think there's a lot of, like, you know, sites that do, like, walkthroughs of, like, houses and buildings that used to use right. VRML players.
So basically VRML gives you the ability for, like, 3D environments in a web browser.
Yeah, it stands for, like, virtual reality markup language or something like that. I think... there's probably differences between the two, and I'm not an expert on either technology, but WebGL is actually an extension of OpenGL, an expansion of it and into the web domain. And it's implemented through the canvas tag in HTML5. And now there's an implementation for it in Google Chrome.
And they're the first ones to do that, right?
Yeah, I think so. And, they're up to version 9 now. I just think, I really like Chrome. I've had a couple recent problems with some of their DNS prefetching. I've had some issues at home with my machine. But all in all, Chrome has been in my opinion, the best browser I've ever used. I like it a lot better than Firefox and IE. I think it's even in terms of speed, I think it's definitely on par with Safari. Even though Safari is a pretty good browser. I mean, they're both WebKit-based.
Right. Yeah, let me just say one thing. If anybody listening to the show uses IE, just stop listening. We don't want you listening to the show.
Well, I mean, I actually use IE. It's my secondary browser. I don't have Firefox. The only reason I have Firefox on my machine is so I can use Chatzilla. I wanted a free IRC client.
Right.
And Chatzilla works really well, and it's only an extension to Firefox. You can't download it on its own.
Yeah, I use Firefox as my main web browser. I absolutely despise Chrome. I hate the look and feel and how certain things work, but aside, you know, I wish I could use Safari.
Does Firefox have tear-off tabs?
I don't know what that means. What do you...
Like when you...
Grab a tab and move it and it opens in a new window or something?
Yeah, it's like...
Yeah, you can do that.
Oh, you can do that?
Yeah.
I think Google had it first.
They probably did. I think you're exactly right.
Can you put them back into another window? That's pretty cool too.
Yeah, you can do that. so I use Firefox my main browser. I wish I could use Safari, but because Safari doesn't have the extensions platform, they do have extensions, just not a lot. So there are certain extensions that I use every day that I can't if I use Safari. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, Safari, the newest version of Safari, is like the most standards compliant browser ever. I love that thing. But
Chrome's better.
But I can't use it.
Chrome's more standard supply compliant, I believe.
Bah.
I'm pretty sure it is.
I don't know.
How is Firefox on memory usage?
Actually, in newer versions, I'm still on the three dot whatever fork. I haven't upgraded to 4 yet because it's still beta. And I have not had trouble like I used to in the old. You know, everybody always had trouble with the old 2 versions where Firefox would just take up 600 megs of RAM. You know, it was ridiculous, the memory leaking. But with the newer 3-dot versions, I have no trouble. I don't know how much it is using. Mm. I guess I could look it up real quick right now.
So like I have right now, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 tabs open. Gmail, one's Gmail, so that's got like my offline folders and all that crap loaded in. And I'm using about, 30, 40, 50, 60... 140, about 210 megs.
I'm using about 500 megs right now on my Linux machine, but I also have 40 tabs open, some of them with YouTube video, you know, Flash plugins playing in the background. So that's actually about normal. for this for the amount of tabs that I have open.
40 tabs is a lot.
Yeah, 40. Nobody should ever browse with 40 tabs.
So I wonder if I open up 40 tabs a week.
So let's move on to your next article.
Oh yeah, greater interoperability for Windows customers with HTML5 video. Yay, Microsoft.
So what does this mean to the normal user?
Okay, this is pretty cool. So everyone remembers, you know, Google, they come out and said, we're dropping H.264 support for Chrome.
Right, they were saying Chrome, no video.
Right. So Microsoft said, we're going to make an extension for Chrome that supports H.264.
That is awesome.
Yay, Microsoft! Because, and I think it only works on Windows. But
yeah,
because
it's the Windows Media Player plugin, is that right? Did I read that right? Is that what it makes use of?
Well, it may. Wait, let me see here. I think they talk about the extreme popularity of the Media Player plugin for Firefox.
Right.
So it may be based on some of that work, but nonetheless, I think it's Windows only.
Yeah, but still, plus one.
Oh yeah, yeah. This is cool. I mean, it's like, screw you guys, we're going to use H.264.
Yeah, and that's just kind of funny. I mean, we talked about this before. Why would Google do this? You know, why would... We know why, because they think their WebM is better and H.264 isn't completely free and open and blah, blah, blah. But yeah, so good on Microsoft.
Yeah, they also happen to mention in there that Internet Explorer 9 will support playback of H.264 and VP8.
Ooh.
They've got both in theirs.
So VP8, also known as WebM. Right?
Yeah.
Or is that VP9?
No, it's VP8.
Okay.
WebM's VP8.
Okay.
Yeah. Have you played with the internet? Not Internet Explorer 9
I've
beta?
I played with the internet? Yes, I have.
No, the IE9 beta. Did you mess around with that at all?
No.
I downloaded it. I had a few... There's some problems with their hardware implementation of... Or the hardware acceleration that they added with certain chipsets. And my chipset happened to be one of the ones that were affected. So it worked, but occasionally it would like just not load a page and you have to restart the browser. It's a beta.
Right.
But I'll tell you what. I think when it does go full on, like, I'm gonna really look hard at it, because it has all the things I like about Chrome and a couple other things that make it even better. Like, I think they even made better use of some of the screen real estate.
Well, when it does come out, you're not gonna have a choice, because it's gonna be in Windows Update and it's gonna be forced on everybody's throat eventually.
Well, maybe. I mean, you can always say no.
Not with critical updates. I mean, yeah, I guess you could not install them.
But I don't think Internet Explorer has ever been a critical update.
I thought the last one was, because a lot of people were complaining when it came out, you could just get it, but eventually Microsoft just pushed it, and it's like, you get it now.
Well, there's security fixes.
There are security fixes. So let's move on. More articles about Egypt. So this first one, a lot of people might not know, but a big cell carrier over in Egypt is Vodafone. They're one of the biggest.
Big in Europe, too.
Yeah.
That's actually who I used when I was overseas.
And some people over in Europe might have noticed Vodafone sending out pro-current Egypt government text messages to every subscriber. And one of them was signed Vodafone, so you knew it came from the company. The other was signed Egypt Lovers. But both of these text messages came...
I'm guessing not in English, probably in some other language.
Probably in...
Loosely translated means English Lovers.
Probably in weird hieroglyphics, you know.
That's not right.
I mean, seriously, how do you pronounce that stuff?
I don't think that's the language they use anymore. That's ancient Egypt. This is different.
Okay. So not hieroglyphics.
Yeah.
But either way, Vodafone came out and said, you know, after the fact, they're like, yeah, we did this, but we were forced to do this by the government. So personally, I think this is total crap that the government can do things like this.
Well,
Egypt's government, not our government.
But you'd be okay with our government doing it?
No, I'm just saying, I don't want people to get confused and think that our government has the ability to tell AT&T, do this.
They have the ability to tell us to do a lot of other things.
They do. They probably have the ability to shut down AT&T if they wanted to.
Yeah.
But, I don't like this at all.
No, it's not cool. I mean, I don't know what you're going to do in a country that's not a, like, democracy with free rights and everything. And Egypt's kind of like one of those countries. I mean, it's been a dictatorship.
Egypt is a democracy where they've had the same martial ruler
law
for the last 30 years.
Yeah, there's
so
like
it's not really an
emergency
democracy
law that's been in effect since like 1981.
Yeah, so they'll tell you that they're a democracy, but they're not.
Exactly.
But yeah, that was just crap, and just wanted to, you know, get this article out there, let you guys know what was going on. But while the internet was down, people in Egypt found other ways to get online, and we had talked about this application a long time ago, many Sloncasts ago, many moons ago, called Tor. And T-O-R, it's the onion router. And it's a way of anonymizing your internet access so that websites that you access don't, they can't track you. They don't know that you're originating in Egypt. And a lot of people who still had internet access in Egypt used Tor. So what do you think of that? I mean, I think this is interesting that, you know, they're going to all these great lengths to, you know, organize their dissent and try to do something good for their country.
I mean, I think what's happening in Egypt is it's going to be good for the Egyptian people eventually. You know, once everything settles down and they actually get a real democracy in place. I don't really know a whole lot about this Tor application. It's interesting that they're, you know, how resourceful people are when it comes time to,
right,
you know, organize things like this. Like, I mean, I don't even know like the amount of traffic that they had, but it's just like to get anybody, like, I didn't know about it, and I know a lot about technology.
Yeah, so let me just give a quick background on Tor so everybody knows what it is. But before I do that, the Tor logs from all the Tor servers around the world show last Tuesday 500 Egyptian users requested access, but within 2 days that went up to 2,500 requests. So, you know, over a couple days, 2,000 more people installed Tor to get anonymous internet access. And the way Tor works really quick is that, you know, there are Tor servers out on the internet. Anybody can install a Tor server or an exit point, as it's known. And when you install the Tor client, all of your internet access gets wrapped up in many layers. That's why it's called the onion router. So you send out your internet request to the first Tor server. It wraps it in a layer. It sends it to another Tor server. It wraps it in a layer. It sends it to another Tor server. It wraps it in a layer. And then finally it hits a Tor exit server and gets out on the internet so your request can be fulfilled. But the whole point of that is all of these Tor servers, they don't keep logs of where the IP address came from. So even if the government asked for them, they can't provide information. It's truly anonymous. The website that you request only knows the IP address of the Tor exit server because that's where it came from. They can't track you back to your original IP address. So nobody knows that these people were from Egypt. As far as they're concerned, they're from Sweden or Canada or whatever Tor exit server their packets came out of. So it's a really cool application for truly anonymous internet usage that is pretty much untrackable. You know, yes, you can turn on logging and tracking on the Tor endpoints so that governments can get that information, but most people who run Tor exit servers don't because they're trying to help people, so they keep that anonymous. And I have used it, and it's really cool how it works. It does slow down your traffic because, you know, you have to take 12 extra hops to get to where you're going. Mm-hmm. But it does work, and if you are in need of anonymous internet access, you know, download Tor. There are plugins for Firefox and probably other browsers. And our last article about Egypt, you know, finally, their internet is back on. So everybody was worried for a while, but...
Yay.
Yeah. So ever since January, what is it, since January 28th is whenever they shut it off. Yeah, so since a couple days ago, I believe February 2nd, the internet is back on in Egypt. So I don't know. I don't know why they did it, because protests are still going on. So you think
they actually mentioned that it may have encouraged people to like go out in the streets because they had nothing to do at home.
And I wonder if after they shut off the internet, they saw millions more people rushing out to the streets. Like, oh,
there's no internet.
We can't complain about Egypt on Facebook, so let's go break some windows.
I wonder what the penetration or percentage of, like, you know, internet users are in Egypt.
I always think about that because, you know, from the United States, we think of Egypt, we think of mummies and pyramids. We don't really think of Egypt as a technology country like our own where everybody has a computer. But, you know, I'm pretty sure that's the case.
Well,
you know,
I don't know.
They're almost as advanced as us, where a lot of people have computers, a lot of people have internet access. They're not a third world country, or at least most parts aren't.
I don't know.
You know, I think that's just a misthought, if that's a real word. A misconception, yeah, of the way we look at a lot of Middle Eastern countries. And the truth is, they probably do have a lot of internet users over there. I, like you, would like to see the numbers. But our last article talking about the internet is actually pretty cool. Comcast is turning on IP version 6 for actual customers. This is not just a beta or test for certain people anymore. They will actually give you a router and everything that does IP version 6 natively. So what do you think of this whole push to IP version 6?
Well, I mean, it has to happen. If we don't, we're going to, you know, well, we're going to either not be able to expand or have this like weird hybrid internet for a long time. So, it, I mean, it has to happen. What I thought was pretty interesting is that it said each user has been delegated an IPv6/64 block as part of the trial, which compromises approximately 18 quintillion addresses.
So I saw that number and I'm like, what in the world? So I looked some stuff up and did the math. And for those of you who don't know how, you know, net blocks work in terms of, you know, IP version 4 or whatever, you could have different classes of network. You know, a class A gives you so many millions, class B gives you whatever, class C, 65,000 addresses. And they're all public unless you do NAT to make some private addresses. But IP version 6 doesn't have NAT, so you can't have private addresses like you did in IP version 4. The way they get around this is an IP version 6 address is 128 bits long, four times longer than an IP version 4 address, which is only 32 bits. And the first 64 bits is the public part. The second 64 bits is the private or link local part of the IP version 6 address. So Comcast isn't trying to give people 18 quintillion addresses because they think they can use them. That is literally the lowest amount of addresses you can give a single user. By giving somebody a single public IP version 6 address, they still have those 64 bits of link local addresses to use, which give them 18 quintillion IPs.
Yeah, so I mean, it's basically 18 quintillion times 18 quintillion.
Yeah, is like the total number.
I mean, and to give people some perspective, IPv4 was 32 bits. That was about 4 billion addresses,
right?
Which is not even quite one IP address for every person in the world.
Right. And the article, we don't have it here, but the last slash 8s were actually given out last week. I watched the live broadcast. There are no more available IP version 4 addresses available for purchase. They've all been purchased by regional internet providers, and so they're gone. So, yeah, the push to IPv6 has to happen soon.
Yepers. I'm glad to see somebody's doing it.
Yeah, very cool. I hate Comcast for many things, but the IP version 6 deployment is awesome. So, remember how we said if you live in Australia, you're probably on a dating site? Well, congratulations. If you live anywhere, you're probably on a dating site now. Because a new dating site decided they're going to scrape Facebook profiles and make dating site profiles for anybody they can find with public information on Facebook. How awesome is that?
Pretty awesome.
So the website lovelyfaces.com scraped over 250,000 Facebook profiles and created, you know, dating site profiles for all of these people. And I don't think we need to go into any more detail because we all said this sucked whenever the company in Australia did it.
Yeah, just protect as much information as you can on your Facebook profile.
That's pretty much
maybe it. Maybe too late now.
But. Yeah, it's probably too late. So maybe check out lovely-faces.com and see if you have an account. See if your face shows up anywhere. And if it does, maybe delete it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this just goes to show you keep your Facebook profiles private. So, Ryan, how much money do you have to, say, buy a website?
Me?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Would you like to buy MySpace? Because it's for sale.
It doesn't surprise me.
Yeah, we talked about this for a long time, just joking about, you know, why is MySpace still around? Well, News Corp is now thinking the same thing. The owner of MySpace says, we give up. We want to sell it. I personally hope that nobody buys it.
Well, I mean, honestly, I wouldn't mind seeing some decent competition to Facebook.
Oh, I would love to see decent
like
competition.
Like, imagine somebody like Google buying it and, like, totally turning it around. Because Google, one time...
Google has Orkut.
Yeah, Okrit or Orkut?
Orkut, O-R-K-U-T. It's very big in Orkut. Brazil.
Okay, well, I mean, but I thought at one time Google might have had some early investment in MySpace way back.
I don't know.
But nonetheless, it'd be cool just to see some other competitor. I don't care who buys it. Microsoft, Google, Apple.
I would love to see another competitor. I mean, there is Orkut. There is Diaspora, which is a new, I think it might still be in beta, but it's supposedly an open source version of Facebook that's more open. And I just don't want to see MySpace be that competitor.
Why?
It sucks.
Well, it does now, but I mean, it's never had like the privacy problems that Facebook has.
Has it? Or do people just not notice because nobody uses it?
Maybe.
I just don't like how people can customize their pages and you get sparkly backgrounds and animated crap. Like, get rid of it. I hate it. So we did mention before that you had never visited Chatroulette.
No.
Well, you might be able to get the same type of features by adding an application called Rounds on Facebook. Rounds is actually Chatroulette for Facebook. You install this application and you can get random video chats with random people on Facebook. Would you ever do this?
I have no desire to chat with random people like on audio, let alone video.
That's true. My chatting with random people stopped in the IRC days, and I don't even do that anymore.
I should have requalified that, let alone, you know, text
right
versus audio.
I just don't like people.
Well, it's not that. It's just I have enough friends.
That's true. What do you need more friends for?
Exactly.
But they are trying to be a little more sensitive to people in that they're not going to pair a 14-year-old with a 54-year-old. You know, they're going to try to keep like interests by looking at your Facebook profile, seeing what you've typed and matching people up. But yeah, it's still interesting that some company is trying to be Chatroulette version 2. We have yet to see whether there is a nudity, you know, every other click like there is on Chatroulette. So do you use Flickr?
You know, I saw this article and it actually like sort of spawned me to go off, and I do have a Flickr account. I was like, oh man, what do I have on my Flickr account? I haven't been there for a while.
Do I want to lose it?
Yeah. So I went and I looked. Go ahead. Yeah, I do use it, but not too much.
Yeah, I have an account too, and I don't use it, mostly because unless you pay for a pro account, there's not enough storage space for anything. But this one user had about 3,400 photos. He really used Flickr. He paid for a pro account.
That's a lot of photos.
That's a lot of photos. And Flickr deleted it.
Oops.
So there was
a hard drive crash, and we forgot to fire up our Windows home server.
No, it wasn't even that. Some admin for Flickr actually deleted his profile. So they actually wanted to delete somebody else's profile, and they ended up accidentally deleting his, and all of his images were gone. And at first, they're like, whoa, we mixed up the accounts and accidentally deleted yours. We can restore your account, but we can't get your photos. So sorry about that. Goodbye.
His name's Mirko Wilhelm. Who are they? Are they trying to delete Kaiser Wilhelm's photo archive or something?
Who knows?
It's crazy. What a weird name.
But yeah, so at first they're like, yeah, sorry, we deleted your account, but we can't do anything about it, and we're, you know, not going to do anything for you. Here's a free 4 years of a free pro account to make up for losing all of your data. So a couple days went by. And the Flickr people were actually able to recover all of his photos. 3,410 photos were restored. And the coolest part, his pro account was extended for free to the year 2036. So pro accounts are only, what, $25 a year? They're not that expensive. But still, for all the pain that this dude went through, thinking that his whole life was gone.
His whole Flickr account.
Yeah, I mean, and for some people, like, this is what makes them money. Like, they post pictures on there. Their pictures get added to, you know, these major corporations' Flickr pools. Their images are shown on other websites and linked. And this is how they get business. And this dude's whole life was just gone.
So that's kind of what I was, when I started looking up Flickr again or looking into it. To me, it's like, this is just a place to put your photos. But like, so you, people link to this and they get business. What kind of business do they get? Like, you're a good photographer, we'll hire you?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so you don't make money from Flickr. You're just,
It's like an online portfolio system.
It's exactly what it is. So you're linking on these other sites to your Flickr photos, assuming that they're always going to be there.
Yeah.
And then this guy had everything deleted. So anybody who linked to him, any pools where people had said, hey, you have a good image, can we add it to our group? All that was gone.
I think I messed around a little bit with their like organizing software. I mean, it's pretty cool. They have a nice little applet that loads into your browser. And, or not if it's an applet, but it's some kind of...
I actually think it is a Java applet.
It works well. Like, I mean, you can toss around the photos with your, you know, with your mouse, and
right.
It's pretty responsive, and you can like batch process stuff.
For an online application, it's really good.
Yeah, on that end of it. But the thing that I don't like about Flickr is the layout. Like, you know, you go to somebody's Flickr photo stream, and like, you get this odd view of like. Like a picture, it's not very big. Like, it, in my opinion, like if it's about the photos, it should be like a big photo of it, you know? And I just don't know how it would fit into. I mean, I do take a lot of pictures. I post most of my stuff on Facebook, ones I find interesting, and everything else just stays in my Picasa albums on my computer.
So just local then?
Yeah. And Picasa has the ability to sync up to a web album. On PicassoWeb.google, you know, and I do that every once in a while, but I just don't have a whole lot of use for Flickr. I'm not a professional photographer. Maybe if I were, you know, I'd put stuff up there, but it's not the interface to Flickr, like the whole front page.
It sucks. You can say it.
Yeah. It doesn't suck. It's just not like creative. It's not artsy. It's not at all like. There's no design thrown. It's just kind of like, it's like a blog. It's a photo blog is what it really looks like.
For the way people use it, they want to use it as a portfolio, but you don't get the feel of a portfolio. You know, it's just like opening up My Computer. You see albums, you click the album, you see images. And sometimes, you know, their interface sucks so much, I can't even tell you how to get to an album, you know, how to find out what album a picture is in. Like,
well, they have like sets and then albums.
Exactly.
And then galleries.
I have no clue what those things are.
And like if you delete it, I noticed today like I deleted a set of photos, which I apparently had created when I uploaded the photos. It automatically created a set. I deleted the set and then it didn't delete the photos. You have to still delete the photos individually.
Yep. Yeah, so Flickr, get on that. So, Ryan, what is internet?
It's that thing, right? Like America Online?
Yes. I have the floppy disks. How are we delivering this show? I don't have my floppy disks out. I can't get on the internet. So our next story is actually kind of funny. It was a clip from 1994 from the Today Show where the internet was really just new for the consumer. You know, it was just really being put out there where people could get internet access. And the hosts of the Today Show, who were they? Katie Couric,
Brian
Gumbel, and the other lady.
The other lady. Yeah, I don't know who the...
I don't know who that is. And I don't see it in the article either.
Me either.
So anyways, they were talking about what is internet. So I'm going to play you this clip. It's only a minute 28 long. And because somebody was recording their TV with a camera, the volume is kind of low. So we'll see if we can hear it. But just listen to the way people thought of the internet back in 1994.
I wasn't prepared to translate that. As I was doing that little tease. Little mark with the A and then the ring around it.
At.
See, that's what I said. Mm-hmm. Katie said she thought it was about.
Yeah. Oh.
But I'd never heard
around
it.
Around.
I'd never heard it said. I'd only seen the mark, but never heard it said. And then it sounded stupid when I said it. Violence at NBC.
Yeah, well, I heard the around or about the lecture music.
See, there it is. Violence at NBC, GE.com. I mean.
Well, what Allison should know.
What is internet
that
anyway?
Internet is that massive computer
right.
network, the one that's becoming really big now.
What do you mean? That's big? How does one, what do you write to it, like mail?
No, a lot of people use it and communicate with, I guess they can communicate with NBC writers and producers. Allison, can you explain what internet is?
No, she can't say anything in 10 seconds or less.
Allison will be in the studio shortly.
What is
the name?
It's a giant computer network made up of, started from...
Oh, I thought you were going to tell us what this was.
It's like a computer billboard.
It's a computer billboard, but it's nationwide. It's several universities and everything all joined together.
Right.
And others can access it.
Right.
And it's getting bigger and bigger all the time.
Just
great. It came in really handy during the quake. A lot of people, that's how they were communicating out to tell family and loved ones they were okay because all the phone lines were down.
I was telling Kate.
So you couldn't hear because I had the microphones muted, but I was cracking up.
Oh yeah, the first time I watched it, I laughed pretty hard.
What is internet? What do you write to it like mail?
It's a massive computer network.
Brian Gumbel was mad.
Yeah, he's like, wait, what is it?
I don't know what this is.
At GE Com.
Loud noises.
was violence at
NBC GE Com.
Yeah, no dots.
Yeah, like,
forget the
dots. Do we not need the dots? Do you not say the dots?
It's like predictive text input. It just knows you need the dot.
Yeah, so that was 1994.
Yeah. Interestingly enough, I looked up the at symbol because Katie there said she thought it was about.
And the other lady thought it was around.
Yeah, and I think they were confusing that with circa or around, you know. But the at symbol has an interesting history. Do you know why it came about?
I read it once before, but I have no clue now.
It did start out meaning at, but actually it was an accounting symbol. The example they give is that the difference between saying 12 apples at symbol $1 would mean $12, and 12 apples at $1 would just be $1. So I got 12 apples for a dollar, basically. It was some accounting distinction.
Oh, that's weird.
Yeah, so it's a big difference in the amount of money. And the symbol is actually supposed, it represents each at, the words each at. And the symbol is supposed to be a lowercase e with an a in the middle of it. And that's why it looks like that circle around the at, or the a.
Oh
yeah, that
each
makes sense.
At.
Each at. This is what Wikipedia says. So
if you want to send me an email, send it to kevinslonka@gmail.com.
Yeah, it's interesting shorthand how we now, it's completely probably not even used in accounting anymore.
Yeah, I've never seen, in any of my accounting classes, I've never seen that.
Yeah.
But a funny thing, Rob Pagoraro. Pagoraro. Rob from the Washington Post tweeted, the guy who posted that 1994 clip, yeah, he got canned for that. Can you believe it?
Oops.
That somebody probably at NBC fired a dude because he posted a clip from 17 years ago?
Yeah, I
really?
Mean, no, I don't think there was any malintent here, man. This was... Like, it's like, oh, wow, look how far we've come in
right.
16, 17 years. I mean, it really seems like the internet's been around forever, but, you know, I can remember the day that AOL, like, hooked into the internet. That was a huge deal.
Dude, I still remember in school, only one computer had internet access, and you had to dial out, and you were the lucky one if you made it to the library and nobody was on that computer, and
yeah.
You got to surf the internet. Like, man.
Yeah, it's, I mean, we've come a long way. I think it's neat to see the context of that. But
it really is.
Sorry, Rob.
Yeah. Well, not Rob. He works for the Washington Post. Sorry, guy who got fired.
Oh, yeah. Whoops.
Whoever he is.
Yeah.
So we talked before about TVs that have these applications built into it. And here is an article, you know, somebody, Chris Albrecht, detailing his experience with his TV. So he bought a Vizio XVT553SV, whatever. And it has Yahoo widgets. Built into it.
Lame.
Yeah, I agree. Sucks. But either way, he started setting it up and the app started crashing. So he contacted support. They're like, oh, yeah, just factory reset your TV. It's like, really? Now I got to set up everything again. So he did it. It started working. Another app started crashing. And, you know, support was just no help. It did this 3 times. All of these apps started crashing. He's like, you know what? I'm done. Returned it. And he's done with TVs with apps on it. Now, this is one of the things that I've been worrying about with all of these quote-unquote smart TVs. Would you ever, I think we've talked about this before, but would you ever consider buying one?
I mean, I use online media, you know, through Hulu, and I use, my home theater PC has an application called Sage TV that has, like, online channels that build into it, and I use those. But, I mean, in terms of, like, apps, like, I don't know. I just don't see how. I mean, maybe yeah. If they get it integrated enough and it's slick and it's awesome, I might eventually. And it's just like part of TV now. You know, like if you asked me 10 years ago, hey Ryan, would you buy a TV with an ATSC tuner in it? I'd be like, I don't know, what's that? You know, but now that's how you get your high def TV over the air. So you just buy it because it comes with it. If they make it work seamlessly, sure, I'll buy it. But I mean, it's just obviously not ready for prime time yet.
Yeah, I don't want one because I think it's a security risk, having your TV being able to connect to the internet.
Well, I mean, only if you're sharing, only if you have data on there that can be compromised.
But it's a way into your network.
Well, I'll just firewall it.
Yeah. Everybody's going to have to make a DMZ now.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's not out of the question.
That's crazy. So the next article, I believe, is yours.
So this is kind of interesting. I often listen to NPR, specifically Science Friday with Ira Flatow. And, you know, it's usually on Fridays. I'm usually in the car traveling somewhere after work. And they had this article or this interview with an industry record industry representative and one of a rapper who was previously with, was it Wu-Tang Clan, I think?
Oh, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I think it was Wu-Tang Clan.
And the last person you want to talk to rap, you know, about rap music.
And then another gentleman that just, you know, basically into the whole like idea of fair use, and they were just discussing the ability of people to sample, use samples from music and the you know, reuse those samples to create new works. And Kevin has a clip here he's going to play that I found interesting, and I just wanted to comment on it. So good.
Sure. So let's cue up this clip and start playing.
The killing, you said. Well, yeah, every time we step in our cars, we go on a ride in the public domain, because everything in our cars, you know, is built on previous ingenuity. And at one point in time, it was released so that anyone can use it. So that's another dimension that, sure, I wanted to introduce.
And keep in mind, if I bought that Ford car, I could take the carburetor out and resell it. And that's quite okay, you know. But but I bought a record. I own the record, and I can't take a piece of it and sample it and use it for my own record, for whatever purpose, whether it's commercial or non-commercial. Mm-hmm. I think
the metaphor, though, is if you bought a CD, you could sell that CD, right? But you couldn't then sell the patent behind the carburetor of the car. Sure. Which is yeah, the parallel concept here.
Well, but if you kept
it, no, it's how does that happen? Explain that, please.
Well, the idea is you can sell the objective manifestation, like the CD, but the actual creative work, someone invested time and energy in that, and so you can't just take that and sell that.
Well, the word "sell" is an interesting point here.
Yeah, so basically you heard Mr. Hank Shockley, formerly of the Wu-Tang Clan, I believe. If I'm mistaken on that, I very much apologize. But he mentions, you know, the reuse of the work. And the other gentleman you hear defending the position of basically the record industry is Mr. Dean Garfield. He's president and CEO of the Information Technology Industry Council. And then there's also the first man speaking was a professor of the Department of Communication at University of Iowa, Professor Kembru McLeod. So basically they mention that, you know, in a car, if you bought a car, you could take parts of the car and resell the parts.
And you don't go to jail for it.
Yeah, and it's perfectly legal. And then you hear the industry, the Information Technology Industry Council representative, Mr. Garfield, you know, defend the fact that, well, sure, with a CD you can do that. Like, you could take the physical manifestation of the CD and resell the CD. Or if you want to break the CD in half and sell it for the plastic parts it's worth, you're allowed to do that. But you can't resell the parts of it, because that would be akin to selling the patent that backs up, you know, parts of the car.
I don't agree with that at all.
No, I don't either. I do think that there's a distinction between those two things. There is a difference. But I don't believe that either party is 100% right. And here's why. First of all, the parts of a car are useful in separate, you know, that you can use each part in a different car or possibly refurbish them or whatever, or reuse the materials. If you break a CD apart, it's unusable. The parts of the CD are not, it's sort of like a holistic thing. It's almost like it's atomic in its use. And then the other point is that giving away or using a part of the CD, the recording, is not akin to giving away the patent on the carburetor, because you're not saying that, oh, by giving this away, that now I own copyright on it and that I can make money from this one part. It's being used in a larger thing. So like if I wanted to buy Ford trucks and part them out and build them into other cars, I would be allowed to do that. But I think the reason I brought this up is because, you know, music piracy is one thing and sampling is another. But we really need a revamped copyright law in the United States, I think, for the digital age.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I don't know what to say. I mean, one part of me kind of thinks, you know, I wish they would crack down on people who sample, because those people who sample kind of just screw up the original song in their new crappy song.
Well,
it's just my personal preference in, you know, musical taste that I just don't like these new songs that sample old songs because I think they suck.
There is that. There's a couple interesting things that they point out, and I really suggest anyone who's interested in copyright law or music in general listen to this. It's about 27 minutes, this segment from NPR. But they talk about a couple other things. And like, for instance, the decision in 1908 or 1909, where they allowed, the Supreme Court basically allowed for people to create cover songs, in the sense that the original artist could not prevent that, because, and this is something else. There's really a million things I could talk about this in this interview. They mention is that a lot of times the copyright holders are almost never the original artists. It's a corporation. So they talk about artistic integrity, but not only do the artists not own the copyright, that the courts have struck down the fact that you can't do a cover song because it inhibits artistic integrity of the original artist.
Right.
So there's already precedent for that. Plus, the artists aren't even the ones that own these copyrights.
And I think that's crap anyways.
Yeah. So there's a lot of really interesting things in this interview they talk about. And I if you're at all interested, I really suggest you listen to it. It's pretty interesting. Not that they come to any conclusions, but the discussion's very interesting.
Right. Yeah. And if you do want to listen to that, you can always find the show notes for today's show. Just go to kevinslonka.com, click on the episode 22 link, and you'll see a link to the RTF file of every article we talk about. So you'll be able to click the link and grab the sound file there. But while we're talking about law, let's keep talking about law, except how it applies to the recent Sony PS3 Geohot case. So we know that there was an injunction filed against Geohot, George Hotz, that he can't touch his PS3. But now George and his lawyers are filing a motion to dismiss for lack of personal jurisdiction, improper venue. So what they're saying is all of these lawsuits that were filed against him were done in California, or basically places where he doesn't live. Nothing was filed against him in New Jersey, which is where he lives. So him and his lawyer are arguing that, hey, none of this stuff should apply. You need to dismiss everything because I don't live in California. I don't have access to computers in California. None of the work I did on this PS3 and homebrew was done in California. And none of the other people who you mention in the lawsuit, all of those other people who also had the injunction filed against them, they're not in California. So Sony, you can't file any of this crap in California and have it be legal. So they filed a motion to dismiss because of improper venue. But hot on the heels of that, our next article points out that Sony really doesn't care anymore. And if anybody even talks about the PS3 hack, they're going to sue you. So Sony expanded what Wired is calling the dragnet. And they are now targeting anybody posting information about Geohot's PS3 hack. I think this is going a little too far now. You know, sure, you want to file something against the person who broke into your system, whatever you want to call it. But now they're going after anybody who talks about it this is crazy.
Yeah, I agree.
Nothing else to say about that. No. Yeah, so we talked about this a lot last week. So go back to episode 21 if you want to hear us talk about all the details. And probably even 20. Like, this is the third week we've talked about this, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. This just stays in the news. So did you watch the Super Bowl?
I did.
Did you like the halftime show?
Not really.
Yeah, I don't know many people who did. Black Eyed Peas kind of suck.
Well, I mean, I like the Black Eyed Peas. I think they're, you know, they have a lot of appeal, you know, otherwise. I just think that the show was just like not, I mean, a big arena with lots of people, you know, and football, to me, just screams rock and roll. Like it needs it. You know, you have to have a super duper.
I totally agree with you.
Yeah, energetic band. It's got to be, you know, high energy music. And they're, I just think it just flopped, you know, in terms of, and plus it was just kind of weird.
And that wasn't even my problem with them. My problem is that the performance sucked. Like, you think for a group of four people that all they do is sing, they would be able to sing and sing correct pitches and the right notes, and they couldn't do that. And of course, people were blaming, you know, whoever's working the mixer for them and not turning on mics at the right time. And sure, you know, people can say, oh, they're in a big stadium, there's lots of noise, they can't hear themselves sing. You know, and that's a bunch of crap, because every concert you go to is in a venue that big with that many people making that much noise. Yeah. So there's nothing different about the Super Bowl performance. But what I wanted to bring up was during the performance, somebody went onto the Black Eyed Peas Wikipedia page and edited it. And they added this line: the group is currently performing at the Super Bowl 45 halftime show, where a lack of post-production effects has revealed their stage show to be of inferior quality to a high school talent show. And there's even a citation. I didn't go there to click the citation. This is just an image that we have linked, but I thought that was pretty hilarious. So did you also watch the commercials?
Yeah, I did.
So do you remember seeing the Groupon commercials?
No, I don't remember much about that.
Okay, so Groupon, for anybody who doesn't know, is kind of a new site. There's also apps for your phones. And it's basically a coupon, kind of a deals thing, where the more people you get getting in on this deal, the cheaper it is for all those people, because the companies give bigger discounts for more people using the deal. And Groupon actually had three commercials during the Super Bowl, one during post game. But what everybody was talking about is how I guess mean they were, because the first commercial with Timothy Hutton kind of made fun of, you know, the people in Tibet and their strife. And then he's like, oh, but I can get this Tibetan food with a Groupon deal. And then another one talked about, you know, the deforestation, and kind of made light of, you know, losing the rainforest. And the Groupon thing was, oh, but this other deforestation, getting my Brazilian wax at a discount. So, you know, a lot of people were up in arms about these Groupon ads, you know. I mean, they were pretty controversial because they were poking fun of the idea of charity.
Yeah, it's kind of iffy.
Yeah, I mean, I like the service Groupon. I've never used it because the companies that do it, the closest one is in Pittsburgh, and I'm not in Pittsburgh a lot, so I can't make use of it. But I don't know. If you guys get a chance, you know, go watch the Groupon commercials. They're on YouTube. You can find them lots of different places. See what you think about them. I didn't think they were that bad while I was watching them, because at first I thought, oh, this is going to be a commercial about, you know, Tibet. Oh, how nice. And then he points to his pasta or whatever. It's like, whoa, what just happened here? Why is Timothy Hutton talking about the Tibetan people and now he's eating pasta? I don't get it. But yeah, give him a watch if you didn't notice him during the Super Bowl. So let's move on to our next article. We have a bunch of mobile articles now. And the first one kind of made me mad. Have you seen or heard anything about the Motorola Zoom?
Yeah, you know, it's a new tablet from good old Moto.
Yeah, it was supposed to be, you know, an iPad competitor or an iPad killer, as some people thought it was going to be. And after seeing coverage of it at CES, I kind of thought it, you know, really might be. I was really pumped about possibly buying a Motorola Zoom until a couple days ago, when Engadget broke a leak from Best Buy. The Motorola Zoom is $800, February 24th launch date, but the worst part is you are forced to pay for at least a month of 3G service to go along with the Motorola Zoom. What?
Yeah, I've had some conversations with people that are, you know, that either have iPads or have been considering them, and you know, just some tablet. And I'm convinced that there's a couple things that have to happen with any tablet that comes onto the market to compete with the iPad. Now, I don't own an iPad. I don't plan to buy an iPad version 1. You know, I'll consider version 2 because there's some features.
That's what I'm waiting for.
Yeah, you know. And even at that, I don't need one. So it's sort of like it's definitely going to be a superfluous buy. But that said, there's some things that have to happen for another brand to be able to eclipse Apple. One is the price has to be lower if the feature set is no greater. And at this point, yeah, these honeycomb tablets do multitasking. This has a camera.
Real multitasking, we should say.
Yeah.
Not just freeze the application, put it in the background.
Yeah, what do they call that? There's this, they have that new term for it.
I don't know.
Oh, tombstoning, right? Or something like that. I can't remember.
What do you want on your tombstone?
Yeah. So that's the first thing that I think has to happen is it's got to be cheaper, a good bit cheaper. And here, they're basically roughly hitting the same price point for the feature set. 3G and Wi-Fi. I don't know how much storage it has. I would hope that it has at least as much as the big iPad, but I don't think they list it there. So I'd say it has to have at least 64 gigabytes for them to, you know, to basically creep in on the 829 price
32.
Point. Oh, it's only 32.
If you look really close on the left-hand side in those four white boxes, it's 32 gigabyte.
Okay.
It does have a gigabyte of RAM. So that's a plus.
Okay, well, that's better, I guess.
That is better.
So, all right, so it's got half the amount of memory of the best Apple, but it does have 3G and Wi-Fi, and it's like all of like $30 cheaper, and that's just not cutting it. And not to mention, like, and I think you mentioned, Kevin, that basically, you know, you want something even cheaper than that. I don't need the 3G. I want just the Wi-Fi part.
Right, and I think that's the case with a lot of people who are buying tablets. They don't want it to be like a phone with always-on data. They're happy with just Wi-Fi, and they'll download what they need at home or where a Wi-Fi network is and then use their applications or their videos on the go and not have to worry about cell service.
See, I've always been on the opposite end of this. I think while Wi-Fi is great, and I'd like Wi-Fi in my phone and or tablet, the ability to get a Wi-Fi signal other than your house and your friends' houses is you're lucky.
Slim to no chance.
Right. Where around here, at least, we know Johnstown, Ebensburg, Altoona, in our part of the country of Pennsylvania, it's blanketed in 3G from Verizon everywhere, and in most parts, AT&T.
Right.
So, you know, I guess.
But it's an extra $30 a month.
It is.
Don't want that.
Well, right. No, I still think
I'm just saying that's why I would never buy one with a 3G chip.
Right, but I still think it should be an option. I always think it should be an option. But that said, they should probably offer one without it just to meet that lower price point.
Right, which at this point they don't.
No. But getting back to my original point about the things that they need to do. So the first thing is it needs to be cheaper. The second thing is it needs to be a lot better or as good, if even at the lower price point, in terms of usability. Like, I've used the Samsung Tab, and I haven't used this Zoom yet. But the Tab, it doesn't even come close to an iPad in the feel. Like, and I'm talking not the weight or the case,
the UI. And
yeah, UI
UX
feels
is what they call it, user experience.
Yeah, how I experience that UI, it doesn't have anywhere near that. I have seen Android phones that are like 99.9% of the iPhone, and maybe even 100% in terms of the UI. Whether or not you like that UI is a different matter, like in terms of aesthetics, but in terms of the feel, the feedback, how it feels, I think it's there. So it's doable in Android, but that tablet, at least the Galaxy Tab, did not do it.
Yeah, and that's the thing that a lot of these companies have to think about is, you know, Apple hater or not, the iPad is the tablet you need to beat.
Yeah.
You know, it's the best out there now.
Right. And then the third thing, I think that they have to hit, unless it's ridiculously cheaper or ridiculously better than the iPad. Like, you have to like really shoot for the bar or shoot for the moon on how awesome it is, or it's got to be like $200. If you don't have either of those, or both really, then the battery life has to be as good, because I don't want a thing, you know, if I'm going to carry a computer around that really has no means to be plugged into anything.
Very true.
You know, I mean, that brick that it comes with is gigantic, in my opinion. You know, it's like that 2-amp version of the power brick for the iPod and the dock connector. You know, it's fine when you're at home, but when you're out and about, you don't want to be dragging this thing around. that it's got it. You got to have at least 8 hours of battery life, I'd say, at least.
And I'm going to offer my personal guarantee that it will never have that as long as they continue to do real multitasking. Just for the fact that while they demoed this at CES, they had an HD video playing, and then they switched to another application, and you could still see, you know, in the tile, you know, the Windows 7 Alt-Tab style task switcher, you could still see the video was playing while it was in the background. I can see a lot of people opening up 30 applications, forgetting that they're open, and just leaving them run in the background all the time, and wondering why their device dies in an hour.
Yeah.
So, you know, that this is going to be a real problem for not just this tablet, but any Android device, any Honeycomb device that implements this real multitasking. People need to realize, yes, it can act like a computer, but you have to be careful not to use it like a computer, or you're going to be plugging it in every 2 hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, next article, I believe, is one that you submitted.
Yeah. I saw this on Engadget that Nokia, or is it... Is that how you pronounce it?
Nokia.
Nokia.
If you're pronouncing it like Japanese, the KIA is one syllable, so it's like Nokia.
Well, I thought it was. I thought it wasn't Japanese. I thought it was Swedish.
No.
Really?
Yeah. I looked it up a long time ago.
Okay. Well, yeah. Nokia. Anyway, Nokia and Microsoft are possibly announcing a partnership, they think, maybe.
I like the name that they made it.
Yeah, Microkia.
Microkia. I don't know.
But this might be involving Windows Phone 7. I think, you know, Nokia has, they've stumbled in the smartphone market. Now, I think Symbian, which has kind of been their baby in terms of smartphone OS, has fallen off the top in terms of total market share.
And that's the thing, they used to be the number one.
Yeah, I think they're still number one, but they're now not, they're less than 50% of the market, meaning that the other parts in total are greater than them.
Yeah, they're actually still huge in other parts of the world,
yeah.
Not United States.
Right, they've never been big here. I mean, but Nokia has never been big here either.
No, I'm talking about the Symbian OS.
Well, I understand, but that's, I think that's part of the reason, is that Nokia's never, they were big, and then when smartphones came out, Nokia never really made much... Made much of inroads here. This is potentially cool. What do you think?
I don't know. I don't know what to think. You know, because Nokia has an OS. They have Symbian. What are they going to do to Symbian, or what are they not going to do to Symbian once they start working with Microsoft with the Windows Phone 7 OS? You know, I can see two possible outcomes. I can see a lot of possible outcomes. One, they say, okay, we're done with Symbian. Gone. We have Windows now. Two, they could just let it stagnate because they're focusing all their energy to Windows Phone 7. Or three, which is probably the best thing that they could do, take what they're learning from these new devices with Windows Phone 7 and try to make Symbian a lot better. So I don't know which of the three they're going to do, but I could definitely see this being a problem.
I know that I've seen, I'm not a big, you know, Symbian guy or anything, but I do follow that some of the news articles once in a while, and there's been a lot of, like, I think, fractioning of the Symbian world in recent months and last year or so. So maybe Nokia just doesn't see a future there, and that's why they're going this route.
Yeah, that's very true. I'm interested to see, you know, why would a hardware company team up with Microsoft? You know, is this just kind of like the way HTC teamed up with Android? It's not really a team up. It's just, hey, we're going to use your OS now. Thanks. You know, is this what Nokia is doing, or are they really going to work with Microsoft, make a super awesome device that it's the best thing ever to run Windows Phone 7? You know, what kind of partnership is this going to be? And we really don't know yet.
Yeah. I mean, Microsoft's still trying to make money at the operating system level with Windows Phone 7, which I don't know how much money like Google makes from each copy of Android sold. But
well, if any, or if they just rely on the OS advertising,
right? I don't know how their licensing model works with their hardware people. But you know, I know at least from last I've heard, Microsoft's still trying to make money on this operating system as an operating system, not from the byproducts of running the operating system, like, you know, selling the SDK or you know, not SDK, but selling copies of Visual Studio, or licensing the apps, or licensing, or, you know, advertising. So, I mean, for them to survive in that, they're going to need a good partner that can push a lot of hardware out there You know, I think if anybody could do it, Nokia could. I think if any partnership out there they made, this is one that I think Nokia has been making phones for a long time, and they have a lot of expertise outside the United States and other markets. And
I also think they have the most to gain from this partnership working, you know, becoming a success.
It's interesting. I like to see stuff. I like to see collaboration to bring more competition to the environment.
Right.
That's pretty cool.
And so our next article is just to follow up on something we talked about last week with Android forking and Honeycomb being 100%, different, not 100%, but being completely different and not compatible with the 2.0 Gingerbread chain or 2. Whatever. They're all different names. But this article from the Tech Goblin just affirms that, what we thought next week, that Honeycomb is a tablet-only OS. So Android 3.0 not coming to smartphones anytime.
They did mention, at least the article I read on Engadget, that the feature set may come to the other Android fork.
And that's very true as cell phone screens get larger than what they are now. Yeah, I could definitely see some of the features, the tablet-only features coming.
Right. Or just some of the UI features. But
right. Yeah, but that's just affirming what we said last week, that Honeycomb is tablet-only. But while we're talking about Android, this is something that I tweeted about a couple days ago. There's a new way to get apps on your Android phone. You used to just have, in terms of a marketplace, the Android marketplace, which is basically an app. Now they have a web store where you can go to the Android Market website and pick an app to install there, and it gets installed on your phone just like if you use the actual Android Market application. But here is the thing. This uses what most people call a well-known vulnerability. So basically, Google is hacking your phone to deliver these applications. So there is a process on your phone. It's the GTalk, whatever. It's a Google process that handles all of these calls, such as send SMS or receive SMS or install whatever it's doing. And this online web store uses this service through a website. And the thing is, that can easily be hijacked. It's just going across a web connection. Somebody could man in the middle that, steal the connection into your phone, and call their own install asset, which is the method that the store calls. Yeah, the method that it, or the intent that it calls to install applications on your phone. So
couldn't this just be protected with like a HTTPS?
Well, yeah, but people can man-in-the-middle HTTPS too. I mean, that's not as easy as man-in-the-middling HTTP, but it can be done by people who know what they're doing. So another bad thing about this is that since it's on the website, people can also steal your credentials, your Google login, username, and password, just like they could if you logged into any other website. So now you have another thing to worry about where people could steal your credentials and start randomly installing stuff on your phones because they stole your username and password. So what do you think of Google going to this web-based version of a store and the types of problems that it opens up?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I don't know that I really have a lot to offer because I don't really know how the web store was implemented before. It's interesting. I remember when they launched, 2.2 or 2.3, they talked about these intents, and I thought they were really cool because you could do things to your phone remotely. But I guess this is like just another way that a hacker can take over.
Yeah, this the intents, specifically the remove asset intent, was actually Google's way of being able to remotely remove an application from your phone. So kind of like on your iPhone, if somebody declared an application to be spam or a virus, Apple could just kill it and it would remove it from your phone. Remove asset is Google's way of doing that on your phone. So this guy actually did some tests and did it himself. He brought up the log on his phone, and it's the GTalk service is the name of the process that watches for all of these intents. And he wrote a program called Rootstrap, which is basically a bootstrap for rooting your phone. And he wrote an application called Twilight Eclipse Preview, which is not a preview of Twilight Eclipse. It's basically just a rootkit for your phone.
Yeah.
So he got those installed, And he notified Google of the problem, and watching the log, Google removed it. That was pretty much the first time ever that Google had removed something from somebody's phone. They had never used remove asset before this guy figured this stuff out.
Huh.
So as far as what we can see now, you know, Google doesn't really seem to be doing anything about it in terms of fixing it or removing this ability from the web store. But I will probably see that in weeks to come whenever people start doing it. Yeah, you mentioned the SSL, and at the bottom of the dude who figured this out, his own personal page, he made a presentation on it. He's like, as I mentioned on slide 14, if an attacker is able to man in the middle of the SSL GTalk service connection, it may be possible to spoof these install asset messages to deliver a malicious application payload. So he's saying, you know, it's possible to get in the middle of even an encrypted web connection and start delivering malware to anybody's phone that you can get. So those of you with Google Android have strong passwords. We shouldn't have to say that, but specifically if you're going to be buying from the web store, have strong passwords. And enough about Android. What do you think about Verizon Wireless throttling the data speeds of the heavy users? Because that started on February 3rd.
Yeah, I was surprised to see this. I mean, I think they're really just, this is, you know, an anticipation of the iPhone.
Oh, I definitely think so.
But that said, there was some interesting points brought up that if, you know, they say they take the top 5% and they throttle them. Well, if they literally do that, then there's going to be a new top 5%. And then if that's the new baseline and they throttle them again.
Right. How does this work?
Yeah, they're going to keep throttling down. I don't know how this really ends. I mean, it depends if it's automated or if it's just something they do. I mean, a lot of times these companies put this in their terms of service, and then they're just free to basically thump you on the head if you're doing this.
Right. They can do it if they wanted to.
Right. Rather than, you know, just for legal purposes, you know, that they'd protect themselves. I mean, it's their network. They can do what they want. People can walk with their dollars, you know.
Yeah, that is true. But it's, for a lot of people, it's kind of the monopoly situation. You know, some people only have Verizon access. No other cell service works where they're at.
Well, I mean, all they're talking about doing is throttling, though. Like, they're not, it's not like you're going to shut you off.
Now.
Well, right.
I mean, this has been the slippery slope we've been talking about for the past year. You know, the things that they can do once they start throttling and start shaping traffic.
I mean, I don't think it really, it's going to matter a whole lot, because if the iPhone really is that much of a data hog, as they say it is, then no, it's not going to be any single one person using a lot of bandwidth. It's going to be the masses using. And I think that's what these companies really misunderstand. I don't know if somebody up top doesn't understand the way end-to-end congestion control works and IP networks.
Right, and how it does it itself.
Right, exactly. it evens it out for everyone. The problem is that if you totally oversell it, I mean, if you really oversell the bandwidth, then there's nothing you can do. Like, everyone's going to get 0.1 kilobit of throughput, and it's just going to be useless.
Yeah, here's pretty much the only thing that bothers me about what Verizon's doing now. So if you are in that top 5% and they do decide to throttle you, they will throttle you for the remainder of your current billing period and the next billing period. Any other company, who did we talk about before? Was it Sprint who was doing this, or T-Mobile?
I think T-Mobile.
Yeah, so T-Mobile was doing this, but they would just throttle you for the rest of your billing period. Verizon's like, no, you use a lot of data, we're going to throttle this billing period, we're going to throttle the next billing period. So you could potentially have 2 months of super slow data access because you were in the top 5% at some point. I mean, I think that's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I mean, if you're going to throttle for 1 month or one billing cycle. Don't do it for multiple billing cycles. So slap
I mean,
on the
honestly,
wrist.
I've never used more than 200 megabytes of data on my contract, which I find hard to believe for as much as I use my phone. But, I mean, I'm not really even conscious of it. But I use it whenever I want. I've never once said, oh, I better not do that because I might go over my...
Yeah, luckily I have an unlimited plan. I'm one of the ones grandfathered in. And whenever I watch Twit, you know, a lot of their shows, and I stream it on my phone, there are many months I have gone over 2 gigs. So if I was on the normal plan everybody else is, I would have paid a lot of extra money. So yeah, I guess if you're not streaming live video all day, every day, you don't have that problem.
Yeah.
But so let's move on to our next article. I believe you submitted the next one.
Oh, okay. So I don't know if everyone's heard, but there was a couple of weeks ago, I think we talked about, there was some kind of like data leak in Windows Phone 7 that people's usages were really high.
Right. They were going over their limits.
Yeah. And they didn't know why. Well, there's been a lot of finger pointing. Microsoft says that it has to do with Yahoo. And Yahoo's now saying that, oh, well, it's the way you're requesting data through our IMAP service. But both parties are really in the wrong here. First off, the way Microsoft does it, if they do it with other IMAP providers, there's no problem, okay? But also, they're using a method that's not really the correct way to grab messages from IMAP. Like, IMAP has a message identifier, which is, like, unique for each message, and they're not using that. They're like Microsoft is using their own message identifier in the phone to grab the data. When they use that method of doing it, the IMAP server returns more data than requested for each message, and it ends up causing a lot of data usage on the on the phone. So both of them are pointing fingers at each other. I think they're kind of being childish about it. I really think just it can't be that big of a deal to fix this. It can't be. I mean, it's a standard. Like, it's got to be.
Why would you do it any differently? You know how IMAP works. Everybody has known that for the past 20 years.
I mean, I know that there's costs in terms of changing software, and there's also, you know, like, they have to, like, release it and get it approved. But, I mean, if they didn't prepare for stuff like this, for bugs, I mean, it's like, come on. I mean, seriously, you probably put an engineer on this for a week and he'd be done, have it tested, and then they could just wrap it up in some kind of update. On the other hand, though, Yahoo's just as at fault. They're not following the IMAP implementation either. Like, you ask for one little piece of data and their IMAP server, like, sends you the entire, like, Encyclopedia Britannica worth of data, you know, about what's on the IMAP server. And then the application is forced to parse through it all.
Yeah, that's crazy.
So, just stupid.
I agree. It definitely is stupid. But at least we now have a reason for what this was happening. You know, it's been, what, a couple of weeks?
Yeah.
That nobody has known, and now we finally know.
And now they're just pointing fingers.
So. Yeah, as everybody is.
The other article was this new iPad newsstand, the Daily. It's a paper, a newspaper. And I don't even know what you'd call it now. It's not a newspaper. It doesn't come in printed form on paper.
A news application.
It's a news application, I guess. A news app.
A daily news app.
A daily news app. So the Daily news app, it's called The Daily, has made its debut on the iTunes or the App Store, and it's 99 cents a week, or I think if you do 39 per year, if you do for a whole year. I don't know. Do you think would you use something like this?
Absolutely not.
I mean, there's so much free news out there.
And there's a cool app. Anybody who doesn't have an iPad probably doesn't know about it, but a Flipboard. Flipboard takes RSS feeds. So any good website, Ars Technica, KevinSlonka.com, you know, anything, it provides an RSS feed, which is a listing of all of their articles. You add these into Flipboard. Flipboard parses through, picks out the article content, and makes something that is better than the Daily. It looks like a real newspaper application, and it's just pulling from RSS feeds. And it might be free, it might be a dollar or two, but either way, you're not paying a yearly or weekly fee to use it. So, no, when I get an iPad, I will not be buying the Daily. I will be downloading Flipboard and getting my news that way.
I don't mind paying for news. I mean, for good content. I don't know anything about this Daily. I mean,
It's News Corp. It's Rupert Murdoch.
Right, but I mean, regardless of that, it's a new entity. It's probably going to have new journalists. You know, we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know yet.
What kind of news organization is going to be? We can assume it'll be good. I don't mind paying for a good news source. I'm kind of surprised that it's only coming out on the iPad. Like, to me, I think this is one route that the media providers don't want to go down. And that is, oh, we're only on one platform. That's dangerous for everyone, in my opinion.
Yeah, I don't know whether this will come out on other tablets once other tablets make the mainstream like the iPad has. Because, I mean, in terms of Flipboard, Flipboard is iPad only also, just because of the screen real estate it takes to make a newspaper-like application. So that's why they're not on the iPhone or smaller phones. So, yeah, I don't know whether the Daily said, we're only going to be on this Apple product, or we need to be on big screen products, and more will come. We don't know. But I'm assuming that since they, Rupert Murdoch teamed up with an Apple VP, Eddie Q, to make the announcement, it seems like News Corp and Apple are, you know, very tight.
Yeah, it's. I mean, there thing I'll say just quickly about news on the web. Like, I mean, I do think that, you know, a lot of us are probably guilty of, like, totally just, you know, we use ad blocker. It's a lot of people use ad blockers. Go to these websites, read the content from, you know, journalists that need to earn a paycheck, and we don't feel bad about it. So I do think there's, you know, they need a way to make money. And I don't mind advertising. I mean, advertising's in our newspapers, and I've never minded that. I've never really understood all of the hatred of ads. I mean, the pop-up ones are bad, and I understand that. But, you know, the other ads are fine, in my opinion. So I think that that's what it is. I also think that the distribution costs online are much cheaper than paper. So that I think these subscriptions should be substantially lower. Like, if they a dollar a day, $39 a year, it's not bad. But when you still while they still have competition out there for free, good luck.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, good luck.
They're going to have to be a really good news app to get people to pay.
And because what's going to happen is you're going to get all these other news organizations that are able to just survive on advertising alone, and I think if you're in the news business, you can't really be in the, like, super duper for profit business either. I think you have to sort of be like an almost like a non-profit. Like, you know, you're in it to provide a quality product and just make ends meet and be done with it.
Yeah, but nobody is.
Yeah.
You don't take a job because you want to break even.
Well, I mean, we're not talking about people breaking even. We're just talking about the corporations breaking
right,
even.
Right, right.
You know.
So our next article, I just wanted to mention real quickly, there's a guy, Patrick Hendricks of California, is filing suit against AT&T for the overage charges of his data plan. So this guy paid for the $15 data plan, 200 megabytes, and he barely went over. Sometimes he would have, you know, 223 megabytes, whatever. So a couple megabytes over. However, AT&T was charging him the full $15 overage. So you think, if you pay $15 for 200 megs, and if they charge you another $15, that you should have used another 200 megs, because that's what 200 megs cost, $15. And this guy's like, no, this is just like a rigged gas pump, where you only get 9/10 of a gallon of gas, and they charge you for a whole gallon of gas. So he's filing suit. He's saying, if I only use 23 megs over, I should only have to pay, you know, 50 cents in an overage charge. And this is the same thing that a lot of companies do, except he has AT&T. He chose to sue AT&T. Do you think this is going to go anywhere?
It's tough to say, you know. And
I wish it would, because
For a while there was a point where the overages were way more expensive. I don't know if anyone still follows that, like the, you know, if you're on the per megabyte plan, you know, I just don't think they should ever be allowed to charge you more than what the package costs. Like, if you use any data, they should charge you for the data piecemeal up until you hit the point at which, oh, the package costs $15. Now you've applied the package to this month, and now you get up to 250 megabytes. And then for the data over top of that, say whatever it is, what's it come out to? Like, usually a dollar a meg or something?
I don't know.
Or $1.99 a megabyte. So every megabyte over, $1.99, $1.99, until you hit the next price point, and then you get all the data up until including that cap. You know, that's how I think it should work.
That's expensive for a megabyte, though. I mean, if it's $15 for 200 megs, 1 megabyte is not $1.99.
Well, no. What I'm saying is they charge you for the additional megabytes until you hit the next threshold. So, like...
But that's pretty much the same thing as what he's doing here. You would have only got to, like, 205 megabytes before you get to another $15.
Right.
But he only used 5 megabytes. He paid $15 for 200 megabytes. Why should he pay $15 for 5 megabytes?
Well, I think they have an argument in that providing you a package gives you the benefit of like a deal, you know, like because they can better predict
that.
Your traffic.
I do believe that.
So I don't know that it'll really go anywhere, but I think the practices to charge people are a little bit unfair.
With every company, it's not just AT&T.
I don't think you're going to get to the point where you pay a fraction of the package price for each megabyte. Like if you know you get 200 megabytes, you pay $15. It's 15 divided by 200. That ain't going to happen.
Yeah, I wish it would, but. So let's stay with some AT&T. I believe you have the next story.
So AT&T and, you know, everyone knows the Verizon iPhone's out, and AT&T saying to some of their iPhone users, if you stay with us and sign up for another 2 years, we'll give you a free microcell, 3G microcell.
Please tell me everything you know about this because I want something for free.
Well, that's really all I know. I thought that was pretty interesting. I kind of wondered how AT&T was going to hang on to customers. And, you know, this might do it. It's a $200 device. You get it for free. And all you got to do is stay a customer.
I am wondering if I may have thrown this paper away because it looks just like normal AT&T advertising junk that you would get in the mail. But it's definitely a sheet of paper that they sent to their one customer. And it said, as our way of saying thank you for your continued loyalty, we would like to offer you an AT&T 3G microcell at no charge.
It says there's a couple catches. You have to stay on for another 12 months. Like it's you've got another year on your contract, basically.
Okay, big deal.
And they must either return it or pay a prorated cost if they cancel their contracts before the 12-month period. But it doesn't affect your ability to upgrade your handset or your contract end date, like your original end date. It seems pretty fair. I'd say yay AT&T. It's kind of cool.
Yeah, I still don't like the way it works that, you know, now you're using your personal internet for your phone calls. But for those people who don't have coverage in a house because they're in a steel apartment building or something, if you already have an AT&T iPhone, grab one for free.
Yeah.
You know, why not just stick with AT&T for another year? Yeah,
give it a try. I mean,
if I get one of these in the mail, I will definitely be getting one just to try it out. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, cool.
So our last story of the day, white iPhone.
Yay!
So apparently Steve Wozniak leaked the white iPhone is coming out soon. So we already know that Apple wasn't waiting for Verizon to get the iPhone before they released the white iPhone. You know, we all know the main reason was they just couldn't get it white enough. They had trouble matching the whiteness of the button to the whiteness of the rest of the faceplate, and they wouldn't release it because of that. But since it's gotten so close to the Verizon release, you know, actually, if you go on Verizon's site to order an iPhone, they have a picture of the white one there. So you will be able to order a white Verizon iPhone. But it's supposed to come out on AT&T also. You know, Best Buy is listing it for AT&T.
Well, now there will be finally no excuse for taking out those pentalobular screws.
Yes.
You'll have your white iPhone.
I was actually considering buying a new backplate for my iPhone that was made of wood. There's a company out there that does that, and they can laser etch on the wood anything you want.
That's kind of neat.
Yeah, and I was going to go to iFixit or wherever and get the screw replacement sets so that I could do that.
Oh, so yours is pentalobular?
I don't know.
I thought that was only the new ones and the ones that were replaced via warranty.
I just assumed that they all were, and... I'm going to step away from the mic a second because it's too dark and I can't see this. No, mine is a very, very small Phillips.
Yeah, 00 should be.
Yeah. Okay, so I guess I don't need that. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it was only for ones that went back for like warranty service or ones made after a certain date.
Yeah, I thought whenever the article said, you know, new iPhones, I thought they just meant all iPhone 4s. Right. And apparently they didn't.
Nope.
So those of you waiting for white iPhones... your contract is probably up soon, or if it isn't, I'm sure AT&T is going to give you another deal so you don't switch to Verizon. So you can probably get a white iPhone this year. Wait for the iPhone 5, and I'm sure there's going to be a white one coming out. So that was our last story we had in the show notes. Anything else that happened this week you want to talk about?
Just a couple corrections. Hank Shockley, the gentleman I spoke of who I thought was in the Wu-Tang Clan, I was actually wrong. He was in the Bomb Squad, which is he was also a former member of Public Enemy.
Ah, Public
Enemy. So I just
want
to make a correction. The other correction I wanted to make is actually the Nokia Corporation is headquartered in Kilmalmi Espoo, a city neighboring Finland's capital, Helsinki. They're from Finland, not
Japan. They might be from Finland, but the name is a Japanese name. I mean, I specifically remember watching a documentary that talked about, well, Nokia was part of it. It wasn't all about Nokia. I mean, we'll have to look that up and get back.
Yeah.
But I am pretty sure that's a Japanese name. But yeah, whatever. So that is everything for this week's edition of the Slongcast. As usual, if you want to find some way to contact me and see what I'm up to, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. Ryan, where can people find you?
I'm on Twitter at twitter.com/RyanLancey and facebook.com/RyanLancey.
Very
and
cool.
And lancepedia.blogspot.com.
Oh, Lancepedia.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting to say, you know, that this podcast is hosted on my website, kevinslonka.com, but I kind of feel weird saying that because you wouldn't be listening to it if you didn't know that.
Yeah, that's true. Well, if you come to my blog, you'll see I usually link it.
Oh, so either way, kevinslonka.com or Lancepedia, and I'm sure you've seen us tweet about it too.
Yep.
And if you want us to talk about something is important to you, just bookmark it on Delicious. Next week's episode is 23, so bookmark it as Slongcast 023, and we will definitely make sure to talk about it. But other than that, we are done. Have a wonderful Tuesday evening.